Welcome. It's December 6th, 2023. The time is 17:59 hours Eastern Standard Time. I'm with you again, Ward Green, being my name. And we're looking at Chapter 1, Paragraph 6 of the Born and Raised article. No, it's not the Born and Raised, sorry. It's the Crucible of Credible Creed article. But I do have a comment that I need to make about the Born and Raised article right now that I added. That's why I guess I was thinking of the Born and Raised possibly, but it was a previous article, so I could have been just thinking about it because I've said it so many times that we're studying the Born and Raised article, which we just finished studying. And the thing I wanted to mention was I added a lot more information to the footnote number 2 in paragraph 12.7. A, footnote 2, where the idea that the disciples rested on the Sabbath, but they went home to prepare spices on the day of the crucifixion, doesn't fit. It fails all the explanations, because as I added to the footnote the information regarding that, it was a fact that they weren't allowed to work on the Passover day, because of Exodus 12 and 16, which forbade the first day of Passover from any work on that day. That is, it forbade the work on any work being done on that day of the first and the last of the days of Passover. But the first day of Passover is the relevant one that we're talking about there. If it had been the Passover day and Jesus had eaten the regular Passover, then that would have been Passover day when he was crucified. Unless, of course, we assume that his trial had taken 2 days, in which case, in that case, let me think. But he was still, If he'd been impaled on the day after, let's say, after the Pharisee Passover, and the Pharisee Passover was on Thursday, then Wednesday would have been the Sadducee Passover, which is always one day before the Pharisee Passover. But that would have meant that if he'd been impaled on the Wednesday, we'd still have the problem of Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. I guess that's a possible scenario, but it didn't happen in that year. It wasn't possible that it happened in that year. But the Sadducee Passover is either Thursday or Friday, is what is mentioned in some of these footnotes, if you read some of the new footnotes that were added recently. It explains the fact that when we first did the calculation, we said Thursday was the Sadducee Passover, with the Wednesday evening being the evening meal of the Passover for the Sadducees, and that was the traditional biblical scriptural Passover, so that it was followed by possibly Jesus' disciples, even though they weren't Sadducees. But it's all of that I didn't add to the footnotes, but I added a lot of things here about the fact they couldn't work on the Passover, so therefore they couldn't be preparing spices, so Jesus must have died the day before the Passover, which makes perfect sense, partly because it says in Matthew 26 and 17 that it was the first day of Passover when Jesus ate his evening meal with his disciples, or the day before is what another translation of it in the footnote of the New World Translation it mentions that the other possible translation, which is fully consistent with another place in the Bible, is that it means the day before the Passover they went to get the meal ready, which would have had to have been the day before, the day before the festival of unfermented cakes, not the first day of the festival, but the day before. It must have meant the day before, because they wouldn't have been allowed. It would have been too late to eat the Passover if it had been the first day of unfermented cakes. So all of this is explained, but there's other things explained in this footnote also, which are too complex to get into in the text, and so I added that footnote. Also, how can we prove the Bible is true now from the Crucible article, chapter 1, paragraph 6, It's the crucible of credible creed. But how can we prove the Bible is true, okay, when we've already talked about the techniques that we are using and they disagree with each other, like the radiocarbon scientists are disagreeing strongly with the archaeologists about the chronology by 100 years. So how can we prove the Bible's true when we're using these techniques like the radiocarbon and we're using the biblical archaeologists to prove our point? And they don't agree amongst themselves. Well, okay, first of all, faith is proven by the endurance of testing. That's something we should be aware of. Secondly, we are not supposing to put Jehovah to the test. It's not Jehovah whom we are putting to the test. Paul writes that he pummeled his body to keep it captive, preventing his straying from things he preached to others. I should mention also, I want to go to sleep right now. I'm at the end of my day again, and I'm still on sort of jet lag type state of mind. After having been up and working during the night hours, now I'm trying to work during the day hours, so I'm at the end of my day. I'm very, very sleepy. So that's going to make it hard for me to do this reading. But Paul writes that he pummeled his body to keep it captive. Okay, that's a very interesting part of the Bible and aspect of the truth. Discipline means also sometimes pummeling yourself, like literally sometimes. And some people take it to the point where we've heard of priests who whip themselves and, you know, it even tears their skin and by using whips that have, sharp pieces attached to them and so on. Some people take it to the point of drawing blood, but that's not what Paul did here. He wasn't talking about drawing any blood, but he pummeled his body to keep it captive, preventing his straying from things he preached to others. Thirdly, Paul, the first thing was, we're not putting Jehovah to the test. Paul pummeled his body. And thirdly, Paul also writes to warn faithful ones from being led astray by elementary things, philosophy, or tradition. Scientific proof of faith is thus, because it's based on elementary things, right? Science. It's thus deceptive at very best. So science is very deceptive. We need to be aware of that. And that's another thing about the problems that we're having in trying to prove the Bible true. Now, how Egyptian history may be seen as withstanding this test or crucible of the genealogy, we endeavor here to investigate. Why are we interested in Egyptian history? Well, it was connected to the Israelite history when the Israelites were in Egypt. But may there be parallels or common teaching between the ancient Egyptian religion and Christian faith? For example, as previously written in the article entitled Joseph and On, the Christian resurrection, lately a credo of Jesus, and that's how we know about it, from Jesus, nearly echoes the legend of Osiris, which is an Egyptian legend. And so it corroborates the historicity of Israel in Egypt. The fact that Jesus taught the resurrection is consistent with the idea that Israel was, and with the truth that Israel was in Egypt, where many people will try and deny that Israel was ever in Egypt. Many historians will try to deny that. Note, too, early Christians were Jews. Now, we know the Bible says that they were in Egypt. We know that. But early Christians were Jews who quoted from Greek versions of the Hebrew Scriptures. That's right. They quoted from the Greek Septuagint. The Greek version of the Hebrew Scriptures was made in Egypt during the time that the Ptolemies ruled there. What are we reading here? Yeah, I don't think I've prepared this. I feel I didn't actually read all of it. I thought I had, but no, I didn't get through it because I've been busy looking at other things and preparing other things. So it makes it harder to read because I haven't read through it recently, but I wrote it. So the the Christians, right? The early Christians were Jews, such as, for example, the disciples of Jesus, and they quoted from the Greek versions of the Hebrew scriptures, because Greek was the common language of the day. But they used the Greek Septuagint, which was not the same version as the Masoretic text, which came later. The Greek version was made during the time of the Ptolemies in Egypt from about 300 to 100 BCE, in a couple hundred years before Jesus, in other words. Samuel Kerensky has documented how a number of scarabs was found in the Delta region of Lower Egypt containing a name very similar to Jacob, that is, Jacob Herr, or Jacob with a suffix, dating to the time of the foreign rulers, or Hyksos, who ruled Egypt and who were depicted at Beni Hassan in a tomb painting dated 1892 BCE. That's how it was dated based on... Now, we dated that... It was dated 6 years after some time period, or the sixth year of a certain pharaoh, and we had to put our date of the pharaoh on that as well to get to arrive at this 1892 date, based on 1897 being year one, I think, or something like that. But Egypt and the Semites, I'm not sure, unless that date came from this article, Egypt and the Semites part two, I don't know. No, I think we dated it using our date for, well, at least it's very consistent with our date for Senusret II, right, who was the king, the pharaoh of Egypt in Joseph's time. And in fact, we've even argued that that may have been Joseph himself who was the pharaoh. We've argued that in a number of our articles. Now, Mr. Kerensky points out the adulteration. It's not necessary for Joseph to have been the pharaoh, though. It's not essential or critical. Mr. Kerensky points out the adulteration of the history of Egypt by museums that ignores giant technological advances brought to Egypt by these foreigners who were Semites, and they're called the Hyksos, of course. And the reason that it ignores that is that the it's not clear what the word "it" refers to. The adulteration favors the extravagant exhibits of rich pharaohs more than the technological advancements brought to Egypt by the Hyksos. So that seems wrong that it ignores that, but it becomes clear. But they favor these extravagant exhibits, right? With really, you know, like Tutankhamun's, you know, treasures and things like that. It becomes clear that an approach that considers very many different points of view eliminates contradiction or bias. A very wise comment there, I think, at the end about the multitude of counselors. That's from the Bible, Proverbs 15 and 22. Okay, our proverb for today, little children, is from Proverbs 12 and 3. No man will be firmly established by wickedness, but as for the root foundation of the righteous ones, it will not be caused to stagger. Well, yeah, I'm struggling here not to stagger as I'm trying to read these things. So if I'm righteous, maybe I can get through this. 2 Samuel chapter 5, in time all the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and said, "Look, we ourselves are your bone and your flesh. Both yesterday and previously, while Saul happened to be king over us, you yourself became the one leading Israel out and bringing it in. And Jehovah proceeded to say to you, 'You yourself will shepherd my people Israel, and you yourself will become leader over Israel.' So all the older men of Israel came to the king at Hebron, and King David concluded a covenant with them in Hebron before Jehovah, after which they anointed David as king over Israel. 30 years old was David when he became king. For 40 years he ruled as king. In Hebron, he ruled as king over Judah for 7 years and 6 months. and in Jerusalem he ruled as king for 33 years over all Israel and Judah. That expression, 30 years old, was David when he became king. For 40 years he ruled as king. That's so similar to 1 Samuel chapter 13, where it says Saul was the son of a year when he became king, and he ruled for 2 years. That's why people have tried to say, well, Saul must have been some other age than 1 year old, because we know he wasn't 1 year old. He was the son of a year, whatever that meant, is what it said. And also it said, and he ruled for 2 years, which must have been wrong also, as his total year, but that's the only time where an expression such as verse 4 here is given about Saul. So people have tried to draw the parallels with the other kings of Israel, like this statement about David. And they've tried to say, well, Saul was 30 years old when he began to rule, and he ruled for 42 years. That's one possible way to translate or, you know, repair, rather, the verse 1 of 1 Samuel 13. Okay, in Hebron, David ruled for a total of 7.5 plus 33, which is 40.5 years. Consequently, verse 6, that's interesting because we know that's determinable. We know that King Solomon's year 1 was 1017 because the temple was destroyed in 587. And we've got other reasons to prove that the temple was founded in 1014 based on alignment of the axis of the temple and from Redinger and things like that. But there are reasons, and there are 430 years of kings, although that was never going to be precise because it was dead reckoning. But if that's accurate, then 1017, if we have it right, 1017 plus 41 then is 1058. That's year 1 of David, and that's how we got to 1058. And then 42 plus 1058 is 1100 for Saul, right? For the first year of each of those kings. Consequently, the king and his men went to Jerusalem against the Jebusites inhabiting the land, and they began to say to David, "You will not come in here." So this is the first approach to conquering Jerusalem. "But the blind and the lame ones will certainly turn you away." They thinking David will not come in here, that is, to Jerusalem. Just the same, or the city of Jebus, as it was also called, just because it was the Jebusites, just the same, David proceeded to capture the stronghold of Zion. That is, it was also called the city of David, but it was called the stronghold of Zion. So David said on that day, "Anyone striking the Jebusites, let him by means of the water tunnel make contact with both the lame and the blind, hateful to the soul of David." That is why they say, "The blind one and the lame one will not come into the house." And David took up dwelling in the stronghold, and it came to be called the City of David. And David began to build all around, from the mound and inward. Thus David went on getting greater and greater, and Jehovah, the God of armies, was with him. And Hiram, the king of Tyre, proceeded to send messengers to David. Oh yeah, we've written, I think, I know that was in the Wild Road article about, I think it was that article where it got into the dating of Hiram. I think it was that article, but I don't remember studying that part now. I think that it must have been the Wild Road article, is what my memory tells me. But the thing is, Hiram lived until the time of Solomon, if he was the same person. But here he is helping David to build his house. He sent messengers to David, and also cedar trees and workers in wood and workers in stone for walls, and they began to build a house for David. It says somewhere in one of the works of Josephus, it was taken from some other Menander, I think, the records of the city of Tyre, where they got the record that said that Hiram ruled for 34 years from the age of 19 years old, I think it said, something like that. But we've had to interpret that, so that was a total of 54 years, or 53 years, if it's, yeah. It's 34 and 19, it's 53 years. And the only way that, well, it wouldn't make much sense for Hiram to still, it's not possible for Hiram to have helped David build his house in around 1058 and then for him to have helped Solomon or have still been king after, you know, the turn of the of the 10th century, is that what it is? Yeah. Into the 900s BCE, because that's more than 53 years that Hiram was king. But we talk about resolving that. We've resolved that problem, but I can't remember how we've done it. And David came to know that Jehovah had firmly established him as king over Israel. But Hiram sent trees as well as messengers, workers in wood and workers in stone for walls, and they began to build a house for David. And David felt that he had his kingdom exalted by Jehovah, and it was for the sake of Jehovah's people Israel. Meantime, verse 13, David went on taking more concubines and wives out of Jerusalem after he came from Hebron, and more sons and daughters continued to be born to David. And these are the names of those born to him in Jerusalem: Shemua and Shobab and Nathan and Solomon and Ibhar and Elishua and Nepheg and Japhia and Elishama and Eliada and Eliphelet, David's sons and daughters. And the Philistines got to hear that they had anointed David as king over Israel. I just remembered something in the work about the chronology of David and Saul by Leslie McFaul, which was a document I discovered recently. The late Leslie McFaul writes that the age of Jehoiada stated in the Bible, or that he was 100 something about, he was a son of 130 years when he died, or something like that. But that's interpreted by Leslie McFaul in a different way, as to say that it was 130 years after the beginning of a certain kingdom, rather than that he lived 130 years. I thought I'd mention that. It's fascinating, the work of the chronology of David and Saul by Leslie McFaul, even though most of it is probably not useful. And the Philistines got to hear that they had anointed David as king over Israel. At that, all the Philistines came up to look for David. When David heard of it, then he went down to the place hard to approach, and the Philistines, for their part, came in and kept tramping about in the low plain of Rephaim. And David began to inquire of Jehovah, saying, "Shall I go up against the Philistines? Will you give them into my hand?" At this, Jehovah said to David, "Go up, for I shall without fail give the Philistines into your hands." So David came to Baal Perazim, and David got to strike them down there. At that, he said, "Jehovah has broken through my enemies ahead of me like a gap made by waters." That is why he called the name of that place Baal Perazim. Consequently, they left their idols there, and so David and his men took them away. That would be probably the idols or the idol gods of the Philistines that they had left there. Later, the Philistines came up once again and tramped about in the low plain of Rephaim. That was the second time. At that, David inquired of Jehovah, but he said, "You must not go up. Go around to the rear of them, and you must come against them in front of the baca bushes. And let it occur that when you hear the sound of a marching in the tops of the baca bushes, at that time you act with decision, because at that time Jehovah will have gone out ahead of you to strike down the camp of the Philistines." Accordingly, David did that way, just as Jehovah had commanded him. And he went down, and he went striking down the Philistines from Geba to as far as Gezer. And there's a footnote on Geba, I think it's going to say Gibeah. There's a footnote, but I don't know. Let's see what it says. Gibeon in 1 Chronicles 14:16. So this word Geba has other forms, apparently. Hebrew Megiva and Greek Gabaon, or Gabaon, I should say. Okay, so let's go to... That's the end of 2 Samuel 5. Now let's go on to Jeremiah, because there's, even though this is a short chapter, we still have some reading in Matthew. We're running late already. The word that occurred to Jeremiah from Jehovah after Nebuzaradan, the chief of the bodyguard, sent him from Ramah. This is short. It's short. When he took him, Jeremiah, that is, while he was bound with handcuffs in the midst of all the exiles of Jerusalem and of Judah who were being taken into exile in Babylon. Jeremiah wasn't taken to Babylon. Then the chief of the bodyguard took Jeremiah and said to him, Jehovah, your God, himself spoke this calamity against this place, that Jehovah might bring it true and do just as he has spoken. Because you people have sinned against Jehovah and have not obeyed his voice, and this thing has happened to you. And now look, I have let you loose today from the handcuffs that were upon your hands. If it is good in your eyes to come with me to Babylon, come, and I shall keep my eye upon you. But if it is bad in your eyes to come with me to Babylon, refrain. See, the entire land is before you. To wherever it is good and right in your eyes to go, go there. And he was yet not one that would return. In other words, he wouldn't go to Babylon, perhaps, is one meaning of that. When Nebuzaradan said, or he would not return to Jerusalem, I suppose, either. Yeah, he wouldn't return to Jerusalem or to the Jews from the camp of the Babylonians. When Nebuzaradan said, do return to Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, whom the king of Babylon has commissioned over the cities of Judah, and dwell with him in the midst of the people. Or to wherever it is right in your eyes to go, go. He gave complete freedom to Jeremiah. This deputy of the army, or chief of the bodyguard, as he was called, Nebuzaradan, the Babylonian. And the chief of the bodyguard then gave him a food allowance and a present and let him go. Accordingly, Jeremiah came to Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, at Mizpah, and took up dwelling with him in the midst of the people who were left remaining in the land. And we've seen the name of the city Mizpah quite a few times already in our reading of the earlier parts of the Old Testament, or in the Torah or in the books of Judges and or Joshua or Samuel, and in that portion, or even maybe Ruth, but in that portion of the Bible. In time, all the chiefs of the military forces who were in the field, they and their men got to hear that the king of Babylon had commissioned Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, over the land, and that he had commissioned him over the men and women and little children and some of the lowly people of the land who had not been taken into exile in Babylon. So they came to Gedaliah at Mizpah. They weren't all taken to Babylon, evidently. Even Ishmael, the son of Nethaniah, and Johanan, and Jonathan, the sons of Kareah, and Sariah, the son of Tanhumeth, and the sons of Ephi, the Netophathite, and Jezaniah, the son of the Maacathite, they and their men, and Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, proceeded to swear to them and to their men, saying, do not be afraid of serving the Chaldeans. Continue dwelling in the land and serve the king of Babylon, and it will go well with you. And as for me, here I am dwelling in Mizpah, in order to stand before the Chaldeans who will come to us. What's the footnote there? Let's see. Okay. Just a reference to verse 6 of the same chapter that we're in now. And as for me, here I am dwelling in Mizpah, in order to stand before the Chaldeans who will come to us. And as for you yourselves, gather wine and summer fruits and oil and put them in your vessels and dwell in your cities that you have seized. And all the Jews that were in Moab among the sons of Ammon and in Edom and those who were in all the other lands also heard that the king of Babylon had given a remnant to Judah and that he had commissioned over them Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan. And all the Jews began to return from all the places to which they had been dispersed, and they kept coming into the land of Judah to Gedaliah at Mizpah. And they went gathering wine and summer fruits in very great quantity. As for Johanan, the son of Kareah, and all the chiefs of the military forces who were in the field, they came to Gedaliah at Mizpah, and they proceeded to say to him, do you not at all know that Baalis, the king of the sons of Ammon, himself has sent Ishmael, the son of Nethaniah, to strike you to the soul? Ishmael, the son of Nethaniah. Have we seen his name yet? I don't think so. Not yet. It's the first time we've seen it, I think. Right. But Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, did not believe them about Ishmael. And Johanan, the son of Kareah, himself said to Gedaliah in a place of concealment in Mizpah, I want to go now and strike down Ishmael, the son of Nethaniah, as no one at all will know. Why should he strike you to the soul? And why must all those of Judah who are being collected together to you be scattered, and the remnant of Judah perish? But Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, said to Johanan, the son of Kareah, do not do this thing, for it is a falsehood that you are speaking concerning Ishmael. And that's the end of Jeremiah chapter 40. Matthew chapter 14, we're running out of time. Oh my goodness. At that particular time, Herod, the district ruler, heard the report about Jesus and said to his servants, this is John the Baptist. He was raised up from the dead, and this is why the powerful works are operating in him. For Herod had arrested John and bound him and put him away in prison on account of Herodias, the wife of Philip, his brother. For John had been saying to him, it is not lawful for you to be having her. However, although he wanted to kill him, he feared the crowd because they took him for a prophet. John, that is, they took him for a prophet. But when Herod's birthday was being celebrated, the daughter of Herodias danced at it and pleased Herod so much that he promised with an oath to give her whatever she asked. Then she, under her mother's coaching, said, give me here upon a platter the head of John the Baptist. Grieved though he was, the king, out of regard for his oaths and for those reclining with him, commanded it to be given, and he sent and had John beheaded in the prison. And his head was brought on a platter and given to the maiden, and she brought it to her mother. Finally his disciples came, John's disciples, that is, and removed the corpse and buried him and came and reported to Jesus. At hearing this, Jesus withdrew from there by boat into a lonely place for isolation. But the crowds, getting to hear of it, followed him on foot from the cities. Now when he came forth, he saw a great crowd, and he felt pity for them, and he cured their sick ones. But when evening fell, his disciples came to him and said, the place is lonely, and the hour is already far advanced. Send the crowds away, that they may go into the villages and buy themselves things to eat. However, Jesus said to them, they do not have to leave. You give them something to eat. They said to him, we have nothing here but 5 loaves and 2 fishes. He said, bring them here to me. Next he commanded the crowds to recline on the grass and took the 5 loaves and 2 fishes. And looking up to heaven, he said a blessing. And after breaking the loaves, he distributed them to the disciples, and the disciples in turn to the crowds. So all ate and were satisfied, and they took up the surplus of fragments, 12 baskets full. Yet those eating were about 5,000 men, besides women and young children. Then without delay, that's besides the women and young children, without delay he compelled his disciples to board the boat and go ahead of him to the other side while he sent the crowds away. Eventually, we're out of time. So this is where the boat was many yards away when Jesus came walking to them over the water, and he said, take courage, it is I, have no fear. And Peter, you know, said, Lord, if it's you, command me to come to you over the water. And Peter got out of the boat and started to sink. Jesus said, you have little faith. And he got Jesus into the boat. And they all were, there was a windstorm at that point. And Jesus had come walking to them during a windstorm. Is that true? I'm trying to think. Yeah, the wind was hard against them, yeah. So all of that happened, and then Jesus caused the wind to cease. And they said, wow. You know, I mean, Jesus kept performing so many different miracles. December 6, 2023, 1832 hours Eastern Standard Time. I'm Ward Green, and I love you very much. This is Crow, and this is Cassie on my behalf saying bye for now.